anything open to the public. That is something in our timeline for right around fall, or not fall, but next year, around February, March timeframe. We're hoping to have a public interface that would take some of these specific data layers and go through the state's websites, the emergency management's website, as well as their Facebook page, and then possibly even putting out Twitter feeds and all the rest of the social media aspects to this specific project. But currently, no.
That would be valuable. I mean, that's the way information gets out these days.
Well, that's why we want to get this to an app level first, and then we can figure out how we can then distribute and what to distribute to the public.
Thank you very much. Very informative. I appreciate that. Our third speaker today is actually Mark Haynes, replacing John Mahoney. He is going to talk on a high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. He's with Next Generation Nuclear Power Alliance.
So Mark, can I stand up?
Yeah, if we can hear you.
That may work better. So thank you very much for having us here today. What we're about, as can be seen from the title of our presentation, or my presentation, is that our purpose for existence is to ultimately see the commercialization of modern high-temperature gas coal reactors in the U.S. and also presumably around for export to around the world. And just a sort of a personal note that maybe put this in some context for this area, I worked for the first half of the 90s for Fluor Corporation, and then I went in 1995 to General Atomics, where I worked for 15 years. And in that time period, was involved first in the new production reactor program, which would have seen, presumably or hopefully seen, the construction of HTGRs at the Savannah River site, to the energy park concept and its various manifestations. That would have also involved high-temperature gas-cooled reactors, and possibly to the plutonium disposition program, which early on we in General Atomics argued there should be parallel programs in Russia and the U.S. to build HTGRs for the destruction of weapons plutonium in both countries. We thought that would have been a beautiful thing. And so I've always felt like, just me, that there's sort of maybe a destiny here about these reactors in this area. So here I am talking to you again about something slightly different on these reactors. And let me see if I can do this right. There we go. The NGNP Industry Alliance is comprised of several different kinds of entities. We've got end users, Dow Chemical, ConocoPhillips, the Petroleum Technology Alliance of Canada. PTAC is a research organization of about 120 companies that operate out in the tar sands, oil sands, trying to find better ways to do that, more environmentally sound ways, and these reactors would allow for that. More details on that if you want. Entergy is one of the U.S. nuclear operators. They have two major nuclear vendors, Areva and Westinghouse, four of the world's major carbon companies, have the SRSCRO, the Advanced Research Center, and some other small technology companies, if you will. So we're quite an interesting array of people or of entities. This slide sort of, in some ways, tells our story just in a graphic way. This is from EIA, and it's a wonderful graphic if you just want to study what's going on in energy in the United States. Over here are energy sources. Here's the energy sectors. A couple of things about this that are particularly apropos here. One is that the electric power sector, you know, all this debate about solar versus wind versus nuclear versus everything, a lot of that's just about electric power, and it's only 39% of the power we use. And if you look at the way the arrows go, you'll see that it's actually one of the least carbon intensive, or it is the least carbon intensive of the sectors if you're concerned about climate change and so on. But nuclear power right now, 100% of that, in other words, goes for electric power production. Nuclear does nothing else. and it's kind of a one-trick pony, and that's not pejorative, it's just the way it is. What we're interested in doing in the Alliance is taking the benefits of nuclear power and moving them to the transportation sector and the industrial sector, which, if again you follow the lines, you'll see that those are the most carbon intensive sectors of our economy. And in the case of, and I'll talk about this a little more, but in the case of transportation, we would be talking about using the hydrogen produced with these reactors, the heat, and the electric power to do either carbon conversion from, say, coal to liquids, or in biofuels, or so on, or using hydrogen directly as a transportation fuel. But the reactor would be key to that, and doing those things in a carbon-free way, and also a way that stabilizes energy prices through a long term. And in the case of the industrial sector, primarily these reactors could be used to substitute for the massive amounts of natural gas, and in some cases oil, that are used in the industrial sector. The end user interest in this technology has keyed on several things, but primarily the high outlet temperatures. These reactors operate at much higher temperatures than light water reactors. LWR temperatures are around 300 degrees. C outlet temperatures, our first of a kind in this country would be something around 750 degrees Celsius. And so that makes it, and I have a chart that shows it in a minute, makes it much more relevant to a number of other, a number of industrial processes. The intrinsic safety is key here, so that you can envision, like a Dow Chemical could envision, putting these plants close to their $20 billion chemical facility and never having to worry about the ultimate, you know, losing the value of that facility through a nuclear accident. And then in terms of just the environment, these provide a way to provide massive amounts of energy over the long term in a carbon-free way, and also stabilize energy prices for the long term, so industry is not, you know, subject to the tosses and turns of natural gas prices or oil prices. This just graphically shows the sort of what happens when you go up in temperature. LWRs, as I say, go around up to 300 degrees C outlet temperatures. And you can do interesting things there, and most particularly produce electric power well and reliably. But as you go up in temperature, you go become, you're useful in petrochemical refining, or in petroleum refining, in up around the 300 to 600 degrees C. You can take a lot of the carbon out of oil sands extraction and processing. You get up into regimes where you cogeneration of electricity and steam. Here in these temperature ranges, you can, a lot of hydrogen now is produced by what's called steam reformation of natural gas, or SMR, and you can basically substitute the heat of the reactor and a little bit of the electric power and take a lot of the carbon out of, and stabilize the price of making hydrogen. And then ultimately you get to the point where the temperatures in the reactor, and this would sort of be a second version down, a little further down the road than one, the first of the kind we envision, you can directly convert through some intermediary processes, directly convert water into hydrogen. This slide I want to say before we start, forget this part of it except the pictures. The numbers here are wrong, and I apologize for that. I picked up the wrong graphic. But these numbers are correct, and these just show you the size, the rather massive size of the market. And what these numbers assume are 25% only of the market for these in North America. And I won't do all the math, but basically in the terms of the number of modules for these various purposes, it racks up to over 700 of these reactor modules, each of which would be about 625 megawatts. So there is a massive and varied market, potential market for these reactors. And if you think about the jobs and the economic consequences of starting to substitute these reactors for fossil fuels and the environmental benefits of that, it's a very, very substantial, or potentially substantial thing for the country. Dow Chemical is a good example, perhaps the best example. They are, again, one of our members. They use a massive amount worldwide of energy in the form of oil and gas. And they use that for three purposes. One, for feedstock. We can't affect that, but we could save these other things for the feedstock. But what we would, what these reactors would do, HTGRs, would provide substitute primarily for the natural gas they use for steam and electric power. And I noticed down here, I didn't know that Dow made stacks of old newspapers, but I guess they do. They have, just in the energy, this isn't talking about their industrial production, but they have $8 billion plus of energy production assets for Dow Chemical. And so they use, and most of that is natural gas-based. They use just this massive amount of power. And Dow has looked at, well, what are their options, basically, to substitute for that if they got into a tight regime and they had to ratchet down on their carbon, reduce their carbon footprint. Reality is this technology, HTGR, is the only technology that they could turn to in the next few decades to substitute for that. There's really nothing else. And that, we think that says a lot. And you can go to Dow's energy plan for the, that came out this year, their energy plan for the future, and you can see these reactors name by name. This is the basic layout of these reactors. I'll sort of bore down in on this in a little bit, but again, these are 625 megawatt thermal reactors. We talk about them being in thermal rather than electric units just because they can do stuff other than produce electric power. The outlet core, or the core outlet temperature is 750 degrees. The inlet temperature after the, you know, it's run the cycle, is 325 degrees. See, the reactor itself is helium cooled. It's graphite moderated, no metal in the core. Helium comes down through the core, gets heated up, goes through this concentric cross duct here and does useful work. And that useful work, in our particular design that the Alliance is concerned with, it's a steam generator, so this makes hot steam. But General Atomics and the South Africans looked for many years at basically using that hot gas to directly, through a Brayton cycle, produce electric power. You can also have a gas-to-gas heat exchanger for hot gas for different industrial purposes, so very versatile. So you get some sense of scale, too. These are big reactors. They're not tiny little things you fit on the back of a truck. And that large size, by the way, and I'll come back to this, has a key, it's a key feature in terms of the safety of these reactors. There is, these reactors exist today, and there's quite a history of them. There were two built in the United States of the prismatic variety. There are two, by the way, two species of this genus, what's called a pebble bed reactor, which has primarily been a European, and now it's a Chinese variant. And then the U.S., the French, the Russians, Japanese, Koreans are generally associated with what's called the prismatic block reactor. Japan has a 30 megawatt prismatic block reactor operating now. It started operating in the mid-1990s. China has a small 10 megawatt pebble bed reactor at Tsinghua University operating now. China is, as we speak, building a commercial size unit nearby Tsinghua. It's a 200 megawatt facility. And as I understand it, I haven't seen anything in writing, but they're planning on ramping up and building yet a larger commercial unit. So they have existed, they do exist. There's quite a relevant experience here. So if you will, I'm going to try and build a reactor for you, a prismatic block reactor. And the starting point are these little fuel particles, and I didn't bring, normally I have them with me, but they're pretty much look like poppy seeds on a bagel. They're just a little bit smaller than that. And those poppy seed-sized things are pressed into these sticks, which are about a half an inch in diameter and inch or two long. And then those sticks are pressed into these large graphite blocks. And these things have two different kinds of holes in them, one where there's fuel sticks go down in, and those are capped off. And then the other holes in the graphite blocks are can pass, the helium passes down through those and picks up the heat and moves on down the line. And this is a picture of the Japanese HTTR core, high temperature test reactor core, that I mentioned earlier. And in the case of our reactor, or the design that we're concerned with, it has what's called a concentric core, which means three of these blocks thick. It's a ring. It goes around three of those, and those blocks are about a meter high. And if you can imagine a layer three of those thick that go around in a cylinder and 10 deep. So in a core, there's about one, or not about, but there is 1,020 of those fueled blocks. And then the rest of the blocks are unfueled. Again, a key safety feature. But in terms of this fuel, let's go back to these little particles. If you take one of those particles and cut it open, this is what you'd see. And first, it starts off with a little kernel of nuclear stuff. And that nuclear stuff can be anything that's fissionable. And it could be uranium of any enrichment level, plutonium, thorium, or transuranic waste. And in fact, the two that were built in the United States, Peach Bottom and Fort St. Vrain, they were high enriched uranium and thorium blend particles. And at Peach Bottom, they actually burned pure plutonium test articles, and that worked fine too. And then there's been quite a bit of research and development, or research at the Department of Energy, looking at these as a, it's called deep burn, looking at these reactors as a way to burn burn waste, spent fuel from LWRs. But in the case of our reactor, we're talking about 10% enriched uranium. And so these little kernels of enriched uranium are surrounded by a sort of a spongy layer of graphite. And then there's three layers of very hard ceramic material of it's pyrolytic carbon, silicon carbide, and pyrolytic carbon again. And those they do three things. They are very resistant to high temperatures. In fact, there's no circumstance in the reactor that can ever occur that will cause those layers to fail or melt. Those are sort of relevant concepts. They keep the fission products in, and they're also very mechanically tough. So they have those characteristics. And so each one of these particles is a pressure vessel in essence. So if you're familiar with LWR fuel, this is very different. The philosophy here, you start off with just a little tiny bit of fuel, but you've got a really thick cladding on it. And again, no metal here. So the fuel itself, these fuel particles, are the very beginning of the safety case and key to the safety case. Just a different picture of the core, but again, you can see the fuel blocks here, 10 deep, and each little tiny rectangle represents a separate block. This core is a back to the beginning, back of nuclear. It's a big stack of graphite blocks. But the sort of just kind of walk through some of the features, safety features. This has a very strong negative temperature coefficient, meaning when the temperature gets beyond the design operating parameters, the fission reaction just naturally shuts down. Helium coolant, it has some nice characteristics. It's not a moderator. It's invisible to the radioactivity in the core, but it also doesn't pick up any radioactivity. It's always in the gaseous phase. It never flashes from liquid to steam or anything like that, and it is chemically inert, and that's a key. And it gets along very well with the ceramic materials and the graphite in the core. And I guess very low power density. So relative to the mass of the core, if you will, and the size of the core, there's a relatively small amount of fuel in there and a very large heat radiating area. So just very briefly, what happens if you had a total loss of coolant? The reaction shuts down, then you have to get rid of your decay heat, and over the course of about 3 days, 3 to 4 days, what happens is the decay heat slowly builds up in the reactor, and then you reach this equilibrium point where the buildup and the creation of decay heat sort of matches the ability of the reactor vessel to radiate that heat out, and that's if nobody does anything. Reactor operators have gone home and never come back. And through time, again, if nobody does anything, which is a pretty fantastic scenario, but over the weeks and months following that, the decay heat just slowly goes down and the reactor cools down. And normal operating temperature, at normal operating temperatures, the hottest any one of these fuel particles is about 1,250 degrees. Worst case scenario, you never do anything. After 3 or 4 days, the hottest fuel particle gets to be about 1,600 degrees. Point at which you fail the fuel, and that means not melted, but leak fission products, if you will, is about 2,000 degrees or slightly higher. So, and you never get any higher than 1,600 degrees. And so you've always got this 400 degree barrier or buffer, if you will, or safety zone before you even think about failing fuel. And there's the truck again, and this little guy on his plane guitar or what, but give you some sense of scale. So just the safety characteristics, which are so important to this, there's no need. We don't believe in this, particularly in contrast to the NRC production or presentation earlier, no need to evacuate or shelter the public because you can't have a significant release of radioactivity or significant health and safety consequences in, or core damage in those. In that context. There's these multiple assured barriers to prevent leakage of or radioactivity from leaving the reactor. Nobody has to do anything to ensure the ultimate safety. You certainly want them to do some things to ensure you keep the economic life of the reactor, but from the safety point of view, nobody has to do anything. Nothing has to move from one point to the other, no buckets of water or anything. No power or cooling fluid is required. This is key too, as I said, all the materials in the core get along. There's no possibility of a chemical energy release or a hydrogen explosion or so on with these. And then finally, in terms of the spent fuel, you can do it with or without water. There's no, you don't have to worry about, is the spent fuel pool covered up with water? It's not a concern. It can go either way in terms of whether you cool this with water or just air. It's how you engineer it. This just a little bit of an eye chart, but basically, again, just to show the versatility. You can use this reactor to make electric power, high-pressure steam, low-pressure steam. And those things provide one heck of a lot of versatility. Just to talk about the costs, always a painful subject when you talk about nuclear. This is talk about two different things, what we call the development venture, and then the point, and I'll have another chart that talks about the deployment venture in a moment, but the development venture, there's, and this is basically all of these things on up here, is to the point where to get to where you're licensed and ready to go to construction. And just to focus for a minute, this number here is what we, the Alliance, hope and believe will be the ultimate federal input at this point on this, and that's to finish up the development work. It's not even research work here. And then also, we just to mention, the NRC is currently reviewing quite a number of white papers and input that has been produced by the by some of our companies and also the Idaho National Lab. The R&D status is just briefly mentioned this. The most important part of that, a lot of this has been done at the Idaho National Lab with some help from Oak Ridge. This fuel, this trisofuel, these little fuel particles, the integrity of those is key to the safety case. And when I was at Fluor many years ago, that used to be called a black art, the manufacture of that. It's a very highly engineered, sensitive process, but there's been a whole lot of investment now that's been made in that, over $100 million. And just to sum it up very quickly, they've irradiated so far 300,000 of those particles under very extreme conditions, in fact, to about a 19.5% burn-up, which is many times, it's very substantial, beyond what you would do in a commercial plant. No failures, no leakers, in other words. It's an extraordinary, it's arguably probably the best nuclear fuel ever produced. And so they've turned this black art into a science. They've been working on graphite qualification, materials qualification, and design code, safety methods, and so on. And all of this is going very well, but it is not finished, and it needs to be. On the deployment project, ultimately, when you get the development venture done, there's about a $1.3 billion lift. And it's just, I won't walk through it, but it's a substantial amount of money. And then ultimately, to the deployment, as you can see here, this is licensing. Long pole in the tent runs from, this chart's a little old, so obviously you need to move it over this way, but basically deployment of the first-of-a-kind module around 2026 or so. That's if everything, as when everybody, anybody ever does a Gantt chart, that's what they say, if everything goes well. Some important milestones in terms of what we've been doing. We have completed a couple of years ago a study at the Waterford, Louisiana site. It's an existing nuclear site run by Entergy. It has the virtues of being an existing nuclear plant site. It has available land, and it has Dow Chemical and OxyChem and some other heat-using facilities within about a mile and a half of it. So in a lot of ways, it's potentially an ideal site. It has a disadvantage of being a regulated site, so this would be done in an unregulated type, so there might be some administrative hassles, let's say, but that within Entergy over that. We've done a study on HDGR technology up in the oil sands in Canada. We've completed two studies looking primarily, we call it carbon conversion, but it's basically coal to liquids and taking that process, which is very dirty now from the atmospheric point of view, and basically making it a much cleaner process using hydrogen heat and electric power from these reactors. Done those for the state of Kentucky and Wyoming being the largest coal state in the Union, Kentucky being the third largest. We've done multiple studies for the use of HDGR technology for various industrial processes. The most relevant here and substantial is on the hydrogen, using these reactors for hydrogen production. Our alliance was just in the January of this year awarded a 50-50 contract to study, do further economic and market studies on HTGRs. Europe has this NC2I, and I'm trying to remember off the top of my head what that stands for, and I can't remember, but it is a consortium of industries, much like ours, with the same goal and the same concerns that our industries have, using nuclear reactor heat and hydrogen to do things that fossil fuels are currently doing now beyond electric power. We have ongoing discussions with some entities in Saudi Arabia, including SABIC, which is sort of the Dow Chemical analog in Saudi Arabia on HTGRs as a way to substitute for oil, basically, in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, by the way, have a problem, and it is that they don't have much natural gas, don't have coal or anything, so they're pretty much dependent on oil, and they're using right now massive amounts of their oil, this thing that they make huge amounts of money on exporting, but they're using it for electric power production and in their chemical industry. So if they don't change, and given their growth curve, by about 2030, they'll be a net importer of oil, which is a big problem for the Saudis, and they also have quite a bit of restless youth, if they will. So they're looking both to find different ways to substitute for oil. We happen to think that this would be a beautiful way to do it, and also for them to help build an industry that could employ an awful lot of their youth. We have an MOU now with the Korean Atomic Energy Research Institute on HDGR hydrogen production. This has been a particular interest, hydrogen production in Korea, primarily, interestingly, for the steel industry. And then we're also working to find partners in the coal industry. What we would propose and throw at your feet today are maybe a few actions that we'd recommend. We think it would be a nice thing if the state of South Carolina and the lab, our alliance, and maybe the Idaho National Lab or others work together to scope out and explore a potential joint study looking at either the SRS site per se or around the SRS site or elsewhere in South Carolina Aiken, Augusta area. Good uses or possible deployments of these reactors. We think there are some good ones here. It would be nice if a state entity would join our alliance, as Wyoming has done, to help advocate for these. It would be useful if the state would encourage South Carolina industry to work with the alliance. We think there's a lot of promise there. And it would be nice if the state would recommend work with us in Washington to increase the federal support for this, most particularly, again, finishing up the development project, part of the project. So thank you very much, and I'm ready to answer any questions.
Questions? Vince, you've lost
me. Curious about the status of the waste from 14.